Okay, so we've seen how you can make atomic orbitals, one electron, for one electron problems are exact. We can write them out perfectly. We can use those as a sort of approximation for many electron atoms if we do SCF or some more sophisticated thing. But those atomic orbitals are the ones are the basis of our thinking about things. And then we put molecular orbitals into the picture by making them as linear combinations of atomic orbitals. So we take and we so we're looking. You can do it the way a computer does it, and make it plum pudding things that go all over the place. Or you can do the alternative way of just taking pairs of nearest neighbors, take atomic orbitals from each of those, sum them together to get a bond, take their difference to get an antibond, put electrons in and see what the result is. And you remember the idea is the more overlap you have, the more splitting you get, right? But it depends not only on overlap, but also on energy match between the pair. If the pair is very mismatched in energy, then it comes as no surprise that the lowest energy combination looks mostly like the lowest energy starting one. And the more they're mismatched, the less effect you get, the less shifting down you get from mixing a little bit of the higher one with the lower one. Although it's always advantageous to mix at least a little teeny bit of the higher one into the lower one, but it might not make enough difference to make up for the repulsion of everything else that's involved. That is, this one bond that you're making, if it's sufficiently weak, might not make up for other orbitals that are mixing together, which are fully occupied by electrons, four electrons, and therefore net repulsive. Okay, so that's the picture we're working with, and we want to see if it works by checking from the point of view of hybridization and experiments that we might be able to do with XH3 molecules. Because as we saw at the end last time, hybridization, the ability to mix atomic orbitals on this atom and on this atom so as to get better overlap and therefore stronger bonding, that hybridization on one atom is connected with the angle made between the hybrids that are making the bonds. Okay, so by checking experimental geometry, we get some insight into what the hybridization is and whether this story we've been telling makes any sense. So we're going to look both at the structure and the dynamics of XH3 for BH3, CH3, NH3, as we said last time, which are identical except for how many electrons the central atom has, 3, 4, or 5. And we saw last time that if we want to optimize the hybridization of the central X atom in this case, we can have a conflict, or at least we have two considerations. One is that the atom wants to have the lowest possible energy, given that it's making the three bonds it's making. So it wants to put, it doesn't want to waste low energy S orbitals, 2S orbitals. It wants to use that as much as possible. But also, you want to have the strongest bonds possible, and the best overlap is the most S character, at least up to SP, 50-50. Okay? So, if you want to make three bonds, the bonds say use SP squared hybridization. That'll maximize the overlap. But the atom says, make your three bonds, but don't give up any of that S orbital occupancy. Now, in the case of boron, as we saw last time, those two things agree with one another. The strongest bond is SP squared, if you're going to make three of them, right? And the best utilization of the S orbital, the 2S orbital, is to put a third of it into each of three SP squared hybrids to form the three bonds, leaving the P orbital vacant, and therefore you've maximized the occupancy of the S orbital. So these agree. So for BH3, there would be a very strong preference, since both of these prefer that, to be planar, SP squared hybridized. Okay, now in the case of carbon, remember, again, you want to, for making the best bonds, you want 3sp squared. But carbon doesn't care about the hybridization. Because if you have four valence electrons, and you're going to put them into four different orbitals, then no matter how you do the hybridization, you have to use one of those, you have to get the equivalent of one of those being in an S orbital. You could have four SP cubes, or you could have three SP squareds and a vacant P, or you could have an S and three P's. All of those use up the 2s orbital. So you get the same utilization however you slice it for carbon, which has four electrons to go into four different n equals 2 orbitals. So whatever. So again, you'd expect it because of the strong bonds to be planar, but it wouldn't prefer as strongly to be planar as BH3 does. So it should be less strongly planar, but still it should prefer planarity. You get the real interesting case in nitrogen, because now the bonds want it to be, again, 3sp squared, but the atom would rather it be two electrons in the s orbital and one in each of three p's, since you have another electron to accommodate. Okay, so you want to get the maximum occupancy of the s orbital, so put two in there. So that would say we'd have the bonds then, if the atom got its way, would be 3p orbitals forming the bonds at 90 degrees to one another. Okay, so what there's going to have to be some compromise between the bonds and the s orbital occupancy in the case of nitrogen. So that compromise will presumably be reached by having, instead of sp squared, have the bonds made sp something greater than 2. Exactly how much greater than 2, we don't know. The limit would be sp infinity, that is pure p. That would be the limit, but it'll be someplace between sp squared and p. And we'll have to look at experiment to see what it tells us. Okay, so the special thing is the unshared pair in nitrogen that would like to be an s if it didn't care about how strong the bonds would be. So is this idea clear to you now that we've gone over it last lecture and this one? How if we look at what the geometry is or something about the structure, we can then infer something about what the hybridization might have been. Okay, so this is the prediction. BH3 should be strongly prefer to be planar, CH3 planar but less strongly, and NH3 will be some pyramidal shape. Okay, because in the first case, distortion from the plane will weaken the bonds because they're not sp squared, and it will also deprive the electrons of s character if you bend them and use less than a third s in each of the bonds, which is the only place electrons are. Okay, in the case of carbon, distortion from the plane will weaken the bonds as it did in BH3, but that extra electron will soak up the s character that's lost from the bonding orbitals. So you're not at least you're not wasting that. And in the case of NH3, distortion from the plane will again weaken the bonds, but it shifts the s character from single electrons to a pair of electrons. So that's good. Okay, that's just rehearsing the same idea again so that what I tell you three times is true. Okay, but are these predictions true? Can you trust me on this? Well, we're going to have to resort to experiment. So the classic experiment for geometry that we've talked about is X-ray. So will we be able to do this? Can we do X-ray of NH3, CH3, and BH3 to see whether they're planar or not? Sounds good to you? Sounds bad to you? What problem might you encounter? Say with NH3, what do you know about NH3?
Well, I see the probability of CH3.
Pardon me?
I see the probability.
Let's start with NH3. That's an even lesser problem than this one, but we'll get to you next. How about anybody ever see NH3?
Yeah.
How did you sense it? Well, how did you sense NH3? You smell it. Okay, can you smell a diamond? Why can you smell NH3? Because it's a gas, right? Difficult to do crystallography on a gas. Not actually 100% impossible. If you go a low enough temperature, you might be able to grow a crystal, but still very, very challenging. So that's a gas. But it's even worse, as Wojtek is going to tell us, in the case of CH3. Why is that? It can exist. You can get spectra of it from stars and things like that. Why can't you get it in a bottle? Or grow a crystal of it? Well, just, or somebody said something. Who was it? Can't hear very well. It's free radical. So what? It has one orbital with a single electron in it. That's what a free radical is. Okay. What's special if you put that in a bottle? If you put just one in the bottle, it's no problem. But suppose you put two of them in the bottle, then what? Right, you have two orbitals with exactly the same energy, each has one electron. They come together, boom, you form a bond. So you can't get a crystal of CH3, it becomes C2H6. Right, it's very, very reactive. Okay, so forget that. And BH3, we already talked about that it gives B2H6, although we didn't 100% understand from Lewis' point of view what allowed it to bond that way. Okay, so these you just cannot prepare as crystals. That one, in principle, you could, but in fact, it's very difficult. Okay, so forget X-ray. So you're going to have to use some other technique to find out about the geometry. And the techniques, we're going to talk about two techniques. One is called infrared spectroscopy, and the other is electron spin resonance spectroscopy. Now, I think have you already looked at a little bit about IR in the lab? Yeah, I think so, yeah. So we'll talk not so much about how you run the machine and so on, but about how you understand what's going on. Okay, so an XH3 molecule, if it's bent out of the plane, so the hydrogens are moved to the left and the X to the right, then it's a little bit pyramidal, obviously. But there's a style of bending which is called the out-of-plane bend. Okay, and it goes like that. And you see the other orbital is changing its hybridization as the hydrogens move back and forth. Okay? Now, sometimes that vibration is called the umbrella vibration because it's like an umbrella in a high wind, right? It can go inside out that way. Okay, so the umbrella vibration is something that, say it prefers to be planar. If you bend it this way, the energy goes up. If you bend it this way, the energy goes up. So you could talk about a potential energy for doing that distortion, not just moving two atoms or one atom, but moving the whole set of atoms in order to go like this or like that, right? Now, if you had that potential energy and some mass that was moving, you could do Erwin meets Goldilocks and figure out what the allowed energy levels would be. The question is, what mass should you use? Because, in fact, you have hydrogens moving, and the central X atom is also moving. So we won't talk about how to do it, but there's a way of doing it, of cobbling together a thing that behaves like the mass in this, and it's obviously some combination of the mass of hydrogen and the mass of the three hydrogens and the mass of the carbon. But that doesn't need bother us now. But there's some way of properly making up a mass so that you can treat this umbrella vibration as an Erwin meets Goldilocks problem. Okay? So that's what people have done, and here's BH3 on the left and CH3 on the right undergoing this umbrella vibration. So this, as we go along here on this axis, we're changing the geometry, going from bent this way to be flat to bent that way. And the same with the carbon. Now, the BH3 observed by IR vibrates that many times a second. Pretty fast, going back and forth. In fact, what is that? If it were numbers in here, it would be 10 times 10 to the 6th. That would be mega. This would be giga. And that's tera, 10 to the 12th times a second. Right? So this is 34.2 terahertz. Right? So if you measure that frequency, you know that if light of that frequency is being absorbed by BH3, you know that that vibration is taking place that many times a second. Okay, it's a certain wavelength of IR, and that's what your spectrometer tells you is being absorbed. The corresponding vibration in CH3 is 18.7 terahertz. about half the frequency. So now, why do we have these different frequencies? It must be, well, this one has a lighter atom, B, than this one does. So this one is got a little bit less mass, right? And that would mean it would vibrate a little faster. The lighter, the faster it would vibrate. But it's not nearly enough, the difference between boron and carbon, to make up this difference. There must be some other difference, and the difference is that the spring that's resisting this out-of-plane vibration is stiffer in this case than it is in this case. And you can use Ervin meets Goldilocks to figure out how much stiffer that spring is. There's the vibration that we're talking about, right? And light comes out from those two vibrations, higher frequency in one case than the other, or gets absorbed. Okay. Now, so the energy that light has is the difference between this and this, right? It goes from the lowest energy possible state to the next energy state, and that's 4.2 terahertz, or 1141 wave numbers, or 3.26 kilocalories per mole is what corresponds to that energy difference. Okay, in the case of carbon, it's only about half as much. 606 wave numbers, 18.7 terahertz, or 1.73 kilocalories per mole. Now, if you know the mass, this special kind of mass that I talked about, but that's easily determined, okay? If you know the mass, then, and you know the separation between the lowest level and the first level, and you know that it's Hooke's law, then you can change the bond strength, change Hooke's law, until the spacing between the lowest energy and the next energy is 3.26 kilocalories per mole. Do you see how you would do that in Ervin meets Goldilocks? What do you put into Ervin meets Goldilocks to a quantum mechanical problem? What are the two things you start with? The mass and the potential energy. The potential energy for a vibration like this, we suppose, is Hooke's law. That's what it's like if you're not going up many, many, many energies. So it's a pretty good approximation. So the mass we can figure out by a special formula for this case, right? That's nothing special. So we have the mass. The only thing we have to know is how strong is the Hooke's law spring. Does it look like that or does it look like that? Right, so we make some guess about what Hooke's law is, how strong the spring is that's resisting this deformation, and then we calculate the lowest energy level and we calculate the first energy level, right? The one that looks like this and the one that looks like this, okay? And see how different they are. And if that difference is smaller than 3.26, what do you do? You do the calculation again, making the spring stronger and the levels move apart. And you do that until you make it 3.26, or you do it until you get 1.73. Okay? And what you find, if you take Hooke's law of potential energy and adjust it to give the proper energy difference between the lowest and the first state as you do this deformation, you find that it looks like that, right? And and that is the potential energy. There's a very strong planar preference. It's a very steep parabola, right? But if you do it for the lower energy difference, you get that. It's a weaker planar preference. And this is exactly what we predicted, right? That BH3 should strongly prefer to be planar. And CH3 will prefer to be planar, but the preference is weaker. It's easier to deform. Right? So the infrared spectrum of BH3 and CH3 confirmed this prediction in a quantitative way, telling you just how strong the spring is. Okay, now how about NH3? Now, in NH3, you see something different. Instead of this one peak at 1132 or whatever it was, 606 for carbon, instead of that, you see two peaks. A very similar, a rather similar energy, closely spaced. One is at 968 and the other is 932. Now how can you get, remember what Hooke's law looks like, what the energy spacings look like? They're all even, remember? You have a lowest one, then the next one. The next one is the same distance up above as the second was the first, and so on and so on. You can't get two absorptions that are very close to one another. How could we make the potential such that you could get two energies that are very close to one another? Did anybody ever see a case where you had a potential energy that gave two energies that are very, very similar to one another? What? Morse won't do it. Morse, at the very bottom, Morse looks like Hook, right? Because the potential looks like Hook at the bottom of a Morse. As you go up and Morse turns over, the levels start getting closer and closer together. So there would be ones close together when you get way up here, right? But that's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at low energy ones, right? Where the molecule actually is, where you get two that are close together. A double minimum. So let's look at that. Okay, so we see one energy that's 968, another that's 932. That's what the pattern we want to get. So it's not Hooke's law at all, right? But this double minimum has that property, right? That these two, the red one and the blue one, have very, very similar energies because the wave functions from this well and this well don't overlap with much with one another. So they don't split very much between the, let's call it, bonding and anti-bonding, though we're talking about IR. We aren't really talking about a bond here. Okay? So those are very similar. In fact, the lowest energy state, which would look like this, or like this, right? Those two also would have very slightly different energies, but not very different energies, because they don't overlap very much when they're down in here. Okay, those two wave functions. Okay, so the potential that you put together in order to get this red energy and the blue energy as energy differences that you can observe by IR are ones that have a barrier here between the two wells that's 3 kilocalories per mole high, right? So the tunnel splitting is 37 wave numbers, right? The difference between 968 and 932. Actually, there are decimal points there that make it 7 instead of 6. Okay. But the splitting of the low ones that we talked about is very, very tiny, only one wave number. Oh, no, take it back. It's not because of the round-off. It's because this one goes from 1 to 968. This one goes from 0 to 932. Okay, sorry. Okay, so that 2 calories per mole translates to 5 times 10 to the minus 14th per second over 0.002 kilocalories per mole. We talked about tunneling rates before. It says that the thing will tunnel back and forth. If you start it in this well, it'll get over to that well in 10 to the minus 11, in 10 to the 11th times per second, right? And that means you could use this vibration of ammonia happening 10 to the 11th times a second as a clock. And in fact, it was used as a very accurate clock, absolute clock, for a while. Now I think they use a cesium atom transition. But they did use ammonia as a clock for a period, this tunneling rate back and forth. But at any rate, the relevance to what we're talking about is NH3 is a pyramid, right, in its lowest energy form. Right, the potential energy, and there's a barrier to going from to becoming flat. The flat version is 3 kilocalories per mole higher than the bent version. Okay, so again, this confirms our prediction about the XH3s, that if you have that extra electron in there, an electron pair, then it actually is better not to be flat. Okay, because when it's flat, that pair of electrons has to be in a p orbital, and they'd prefer to be in an orbital with s character. Okay, now, electron spin resonance gives a different perspective on this about the vibration, because electron spin resonance measures how much S character there is in the hybrid that's holding the odd electron. Notice that all the electrons are in pairs, so their magnetism cancels, except for one electron in the case of CH3, which is in its own orbital all alone, and therefore has unbalanced magnetism. Right? Now, that odd electron can interact with the carbon nucleus if the carbon nucleus is magnetic. Carbon 12 isn't magnetic, but there's an isotope of carbon, about 1% of carbon, is carbon 13, and that one is magnetic. So you can get a magnetic interaction between this odd electron and the carbon nucleus. But that happens only when the electron is on the nucleus, not when it's just near. Now, that doesn't make sense to you because you've seen magnets interact at whatever distance, right? A compass interacting with the magnetism of the Earth, for example. It doesn't have to be right in the center of the Earth or in the center of the iron deposit that's causing that in order to have an interaction. But it's true of the electron that it has to be on the carbon nucleus. And let me not take the time now. If you ask a question sometime, I'll tell you when we have a little time about why it has to be on the nucleus. But take it from me, it does, and I can explain it without too much time. Okay, you say, you don't believe me. I'll tell you why. Okay, so here's the electron. It's here. Here's the nucleus. It's here. Now, there are lines of force from the nucleus that go like this. You know how magnets work, right? So actually, the electron that's out here, if this nucleus is pointing this way, that the electron that's out here doesn't see a field that's pointing that way. What it sees is a field that's pointing that way. You see that? That's the line of force that's coming from this nucleus. So the electron that's here sees that. Now, that's fine. It would feel an effect of that, would tend to line up with it the way a compass needle does, and so on. Fine. Except that the electron is not only here. It's zipping around at all different angles around the nucleus, right? And notice that the lines of force here were pointing that way, right? But if the electron was here, the line of force would be pointing that way. And if the electron was out here, it would be pointing that way. Right? So you're going to have to average over all the different directions this nucleus would be exerting its field if you were the electron. And what's cute is if this electron moves around all different angles, it averages to zero. It averages to zero, except for one place. This is as the molecule is tumbling around. So you don't care if it's in a P orbital or something because it's tumbling around and you see all different orientations all different directions from the nucleus to the electron as the molecule tumbles around. And it averages to zero. Unless the electron is one place where tumbling doesn't change the direction. And that one place is on the nucleus. Okay, so the only way in a molecule that's tumbling around that you can get this magnetic interaction is when the electron is on the nucleus. Now, when is an electron on the nucleus? Where do you see the electron density actually on the nucleus? Only in an S orbital. Because the others, P orbital has a node that goes through the nucleus, D orbitals have a node that goes through the nucleus. Only to the extent that it's in an S orbital can it be on the nucleus. So that's how measuring this magnetic interaction tells you how much S character there is in that electron. So if you measure that magnetic interaction, you can see what the hybridization is of the orbital that has that odd electron in it. Okay, so there's a line separation in the spectrum due to this magnetic interaction. It occurs only if the electron spends time on the nucleus, which happens only for an S orbital. Okay, so here's CH3 if it were planar. This is the singly occupied molecular orbital, the one that has the odd electron on it, singly occupied. And of course, if it's in this P orbital when it's planar, it has a node that goes right through the nucleus. Therefore, no magnetic interaction. But if it were bent, then it looks like this. Or if we look a little closer in there, it looks like this. And you see now that there's some of the 2s orbital in there. And if we go in and magnify, the nucleus is right on the node in that case. But the nucleus in this case is in part of the orbital. Okay? So this is going to give magnetic interaction, and that one won't. Now we have a problem, because whether carbon prefers to be flat or prefers to be bent, it's going to be vibrating. So sometimes it's flat and sometimes it's not flat. The question is, how much time does it spend being how much bent to get its average amount of S character, right? So if you have CH3, if the potential looks like this, CH3 has a splitting, this thing you measure in the spectrum that says how much magnetic interaction. It's 38 Gauss. That's a magnetic unit. Okay, that's how big it is. And that says that on average, there's 2% of S character in that orbital. That doesn't tell you per se what the potential is like, just that it's that on average. But if you use CD3, if you make these deuterium, then you change the mass in the problem. So you'll change the wave function, this change the square of the wave function, which is the probability of being this much bent, this much bent, this much bent, this much bent. You'll get a different average amount of S character. So if you compare CD3 with CH3 and see there's a little bit less S character in CD3, and that has a wave function that looks like this. So then you can get if you have that difference between CH3 and CD3, you can tell what the potential must have looked like, right? Now, I don't at all pretend that you should understand how to do that calculation, but you can see that it has something to do with the factors we're talking about. You change the mass, see how much average S character there is as you bend back and forth with these probabilities. See the difference when you go from H to D, because the mass has changed, and then you can figure out what that was like, and it's like this. So this structural isotope effect, CH3 spends more time, more probability, more bent further out than CD3 was, thus it uses more S character for the SOMO electron, because when it's flat, it's a pure P orbital. When it's bent, it has S in it, SP something or other, right? And CH3 is more time, more bent, right? Had it been a double minimum, it would have been the opposite. I'm not going to go through that. So anyhow, you know what CH3 is like. Now, CF3. So what we showed was that as expected, as predicted, CH3 is planar in its lowest energy, lowest potential energy, but it's rather easily bent compared to BH3. Now, if CH3 is planar, prefers to be planar, how about CF3? What would you predict? Should it be planar or bent? Well, I can think of a couple differences. One is that the F atoms are bigger, have more electrons than the H atom. Would the fact that the things that are out here, the three things out here, are big, would that tend to make it planar or tend to make it bent if they're running into one another? Would tend to make it planar, right? They'd want to stay apart as much as possible to make it planar. So from that point of view, CF3 would be planar. There's something else about fluorine relative to hydrogen, is it withdraws electrons. So it's negative. So if you have negative charged things out here, then do you want to bend it or do you want it to be flat if you have these things all with the same charge here, right? Would you want it to be flat if all my fingers were charged, or would you rather it be like that? Flat, get the charges apart. So both those predictions, in my view, would tend to make, if CH3 wants to be planar, then CF3 must really want to be planar. Got the argument? Let's see what it's like. So repulsion between the F atoms should be flatter than CH3. CH3 is already flat. Okay, or since fluorine holds the lion's share of the bonding electron pair, carbon has less reason to use its valuable S character in the bonding orbitals. Now, this is different. This says it should be bent. If this hybridization argument holds, then there you have these two electrons that are between carbon and fluorine, bonding fluorine to carbon. But they're spending most of their time on fluorine. So they're not spending much of their time, not half of their time, in the carbon atomic orbital. Right? So carbon looks at this situation and says, why should I use an sp squared orbital with a lot of s character in it to hold an electron that's going to be out on fluorine anyway? Why not you put the s character where that one electron is that's all my responsibility? Right? And that you could do by making that one electron orbital, the SOMO, make it more S character, not pure P as it would be if the thing were flat. Okay, so now we have a horse race here to tell which is more important, the idea of repulsion between fluorines or the idea of getting S character into that odd electron. Okay, so here's a picture of the singly occupied molecular orbital of CF3. And it's pretty complicated, but you can see that it has S character, and therefore it's on the nucleus there. And it has a splitting of 271 Gauss. Do you remember what it was for CH3 or CD3, order of magnitude that we were just talking about? It's got 10 times as much S character as the carbon did. So it's spending its time bent versus 38 for CH3. So this one is 20% S, right? That would be SP4, right? Almost SP3. Almost as much S as SP3. Okay? So, again, we see that in the case of CF3, this idea of hybridization predicts experiment properly, whereas the simple ideas of polar bonds and so on would predict the opposite. Of the fluorines trying to stay away from one another, or valence electron pair repulsion, things like that. Now, there are different goals for the different ways of addressing these quantum mechanical problems depending on who's doing it. First, there's the experimental molecule that we're anthropomorphizing here. Okay, then there's the computer that can do the calculation when you just plug in the numbers and see what comes out. And there's you, right, who's trying to figure out why things work the way they do. So these are three different audiences thinking about how quantum mechanics works. Now, the experimental molecule has as its only goal to minimize the energy, the potential energy, but also the kinetic energy. So it wants to spread out wave functions to get low kinetic energy, but it wants to keep electrons near nuclei to get low potential energy, and the electron settles down to the close enough to the nucleus that it has lowish potential energy, but not so much that it gets really super kinetic energy, and it just does it, right? That's what comes naturally to an electron in a molecule or an atom. And the result of this is that you get a certain structure for a molecule, total electron density that you can observe by X-ray, energies that we just talked about that you can observe by IR, a nuclear electron density that you can see by electron spin resonance that we just talked about. There's a dipole moment that the center of positive charge is not the same as the center of negative charge, and so on. All these things can be determined experimentally and just come from the molecule doing what's come naturally to make the electrons as low in energy as possible. And taking into account nuclear repulsion, of course, which is what keeps everything from just collapsing. Okay, now a computer approaches the problem rather differently. Its idea is to minimize the total energy, same as a molecule, but it does it using Schrödinger's equation, But it can't solve Schrödinger's equation. Schrödinger's equation is too complicated. So it has to be realistic. It has to use some constraints. It has to do something like use orbitals and try to correct for electron repulsion by self-consistent field or configuration interaction or density functional theory or one of these complicated things. It has to decide when it's making up an orbital, a molecular orbital, as a linear combination of atomic orbitals, just how many atomic orbitals are you going to use? How many atomic orbitals are there for an H-like atom? How many orbitals are possible? There's 1s, 2s, 3 2p's, 3s, 3 3p's, 5 3d's. How many altogether? All possible orbitals for an atom. You know this. Roy? They're an infinite number. So obviously the computer can't use all of them. It has to decide which set it's going to use, that this is probably going to be enough for this problem within realistic limits. That's called choosing the basis set, how many atomic orbitals you're going to use. So the computer never solves the Schrödinger equation for anything other than a hydrogen atom, which you can do by just looking up in the table. Okay, so it minimizes the energy, same as the molecule does, by using the Schrödinger equation, but with realistic constraints. And the question is finding out what's realistic. Okay, so as computers get bigger and faster, you can use less constraining constraints. Okay, so you do this kind of thing, and then what is it gives then its goal, the goal. Is to give useful prediction of properties, right? It doesn't have to be precise, just so that it's useful. Okay, and so those can come out as numbers, right? Fine, you look up what's the what will be the UV absorption, the energy absorbed by a UV given rise to absorption of a UV photon. Okay, so you can do that kind of thing. And how do you know if it's true? Here you know it's true because it's the real thing. Here you only know if it's true if you did the right constraints, right, by seeing whether experiment agrees with it. Now, you don't do it that way because your brain doesn't work the way a computer does. And your goal is different. Your goal is to understand. The computer doesn't try to understand. It just tries to predict properties by putting out numbers. But you want to understand how bonding works and how reactions happen. And you want to use the simplest possible realistic model. Now, this is a problem. It has to be simple so that our brains can cope with it, but it has to be realistic in order to be useful, and that obviously is that there's a tension between those things because you can make it too simple so that it's not realistic anymore. Okay, so anyhow, how do we do it? By looking at localized bonds, pairwise interactions, instead of things like the computer does that go over the whole molecule. We talk about lone pairs, about hybridization, about energy match and overlap. And soon we'll be talking a lot about highest occupied and lowest unoccupied molecular orbitals. And our goal is to get qualitative insight, not to get numbers that are as good as the numbers that a computer can get if it's working properly, but something that we can deal with in our heads to understand how this works, and it can be validated both by comparing with experiment, but also by comparing with a computer program that's sufficiently complicated. Okay, so there are these perspectives. The molecule deals with reality, the computer deals with an approximate Schrödinger equation, and we deal with bonds. Okay? So now we had some of the, when we were talking about bonds right at the beginning with Lewis and so on, we had some pathological bonding cases. For example, that three-membered ring turned out to be really weird. It had a missing bond, and it had bent bonds. And now we're in a position to understand this. Now, would a computer molecular orbital provide understanding of this? Not really. There's the molecular framework. And here's one of the MOs I'm going to show you. There are 33 occupied molecular orbitals. I'm going to show you the 32nd, the one next to the top. and it looks like that. And you can see electron density here and electron density here out where those bent bonds are. But of course, this is just one of the or of those orbitals, and there are a zillion of them all on top of one another, and it's impossible in your brain to figure out whether that really explains in any sense the bent bonds. So it's far too complicated to answer the question why the bonds are bent. Okay, but if we look at it in terms of bonds, we see that the best overlap, when you have 60 degree angles here, the best overlap comes when the hybrid orbitals point this direction, not toward one another. Now that seems really weird. You'd think the bonding would be best if these hybrids are pointing straight toward one another rather than this way. But remember, the direction they point depends on how much S and how much P is there. So this angle can't be less than 90 degrees. Even if you use pure P orbitals, they'd form an angle of 90 degrees, right? So there, if it was a P orbital, it would point along that yellow line, 90 degrees there, okay? But in fact, it points out a little bit more. So an SP 4.1 points in this direction. Now, why use SP 4.1? Oh, sorry, I didn't get back. The reason we use SP 4.1 is that it extends out in toward the other one. Rather than extending out to the bottom, it extends to the top. So you actually get the best overlap by putting P character in, which makes the orbitals come apart from one another as far as they point, but extend in this direction so that net overlap is best. By extending in one direction, you get better overlap, even though they don't point toward one another. So that crazy angle, in fact, gives the best overlap and puts the electron density out here, not along the bond between them. Okay, now how about that missing bond? Well, if you form these other bonds from this carbon, this one that we just talked about, and also that one, which is the mirror image almost of that one, or this one, if you form those in that direction, in those directions, then what's left over for the last hybrid orbital? It turns out to be SP 1.4, which points way out this direction and way out this direction, and hardly any overlap in the middle. So that's why there's no bond there, because the best total overlap is when you get high overlap in the other three, but hardly any for this bond. So rehybridizing to strengthen this bond would weaken six other bonds. So it's better to give up on this one. Okay. Now, BH3, this is exactly what we've seen before. You can be nature and look at the total electron density, molecular orbitals in the computer, or we can do bonding. So I'm just going to zip through this really quick in 1 minute here, because we've done exactly this before. Here's BH3, right? Here's mostly the 1s of boron is the, if we look at the very highest density. We're looking at total electron density at different contours. If we then go out to a lower density, we see that and then that. Notice it has a dimple there. That's because the electrons are spending more time near hydrogen than near the boron. Okay? So they take electron density from the valence orbitals of boron because they're mismatched in energy. It looks more like hydrogen than it does in boron. Okay, if we go out further and further, there's the van der Waals surface. In fact, that's what defines the van der Waals surface, is where the electron density is total electron density is 0.002. at least for purposes of this program. And if you look at what energy a proton would have at different points on that surface, you see the proton would be low in energy near the hydrogens and high in energy near the boron, because the electrons are unevenly shared, spending more of their time on the hydrogens than near the boron. Okay, H minus B plus. Okay, now, your point of view, the computer uses these delocalized molecular orbitals, and I'll do this next time. There's about 2 more minutes you need to go someplace, so we'll see you then. Oh, one question while you're all here, though. I'm going to have to do another makeup lecture at some time. I sent you this email. Would you rather do it this Friday or put it off mañana, side of thing, after the next exam? Either way is fine with me. Put it off? Okay, good. The one disadvantage with putting it off is my review session will be before the last lecture that's on the exam. But that's, it's still okay with me. Okay, put it off? How many people would prefer to put it off?
Well, the
time that got quite a few people here before was on Friday afternoon about 3:30 or something after perspectives would be over, so some people are up in this vicinity anyhow. But we could do it another Friday afternoon or it could be on like Thursday night when there's a discussion section I could trade. How many people would like, say, to have it, to have the makeup? So if we do a makeup, then there'll be the lecture next Wednesday, a week from Wednesday, will not be on the exam. The exam's the following Monday, so you're going to have quite a bit of time to get ready for the exam. So it could either be that the Wednesday lecture won't be on the exam, or the Wednesday lecture will be on the sorry, this is so complicated. The Wednesday lecture could not be on the exam because I will have given another lecture before then, either Thursday night or Friday afternoon, say. Or we can just put the problem off and the Wednesday question will be, the Wednesday lecture will be on the Monday exam and we'll do a makeup lecture sometime later. Is that what you would prefer? How many would prefer to have a makeup lecture this week? So that we're, and how many would prefer having it some other time? The vote's pretty clear, so we'll do it this. Now, how many people would prefer it Thursday evening, and how many people would prefer it when a Friday afternoon? Thursday evening wins. Just let me get this a second, and I'll be right with you.